On Wednesday morning, we take you back in time with Felix Bonnell, and tucked away in a forested part of Shoreline is a unique artifact dating to World War II, when that area was home to a sprawling U.S. Navy hospital. A resident historian, Felix Bonnell, took a walk through the woods and met up with a group looking to raise the profile of a forgotten but still sacred landmark. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, I had never heard of this particular place until I got an email from Janet Way of the Shoreline Preservation Society. I met her recently on the grounds of Furcrest. That's a Washington Department of Social and Health Services school that's on Washington Department of Natural Resources land north of 145th, not far from Shorecrest High School and Hamlin Park. Now, during World War II, that area was the site of U.S. Naval Hospital Seattle. At its peak, there were a 2,000-bed facility there for wounded sailors to recover and hundreds of personnel. 77 years ago this week, a very special building was dedicated there. That music at the top was sung at the ceremony. And tucked into the trees, that building is still standing.
It has a beautiful window, which we can go around the other side and see. And then all the woodwork, there's a whole lot of beautiful woodwork inside. That's all original, nice. All custom built. And they built it incredibly fast. They built it, the groundbreaking was in June 1944, and it was finished by November. And so they did a really good job of building it.
Yeah, that's Shoreline resident Janet Way. Now, what this is, it's a non-denominational chapel, first of its kind in the country, one of the only buildings left from the U.S. Navy Hospital and still serving in its original role. And that hospital closed way back in 1947. Architecturally, it's a Tudor Revival chapel, and it's in this amazing forested setting. Janet's group, Shoreline Preservation Society, successfully nominated the chapel to the Shoreline Landmarks Register. They battled a bit with DSHS over the nomination and the boundaries of the land included in the designation, and the pandemic made the process stretch out a bit, but it's official as of a few months ago. I asked Janet why she and her group have devoted so much time and energy to getting the chapel listed as a Shoreline Landmark.
Number one, it's beautiful. It's the most beautiful building in Shoreline, in my humble opinion. And also because of its relationship with the forest, it's meaningful. Because, you know, we've lost quite a bit of forest in the north end here with, you know, development and light rail, for instance. It was a big swath of forest that was lost for that. And so it's really valuable for that reason, but also it's really inspirational, the whole story of Captain Boone and what he did.
Yeah, Captain Boone, later Vice Admiral Joel T. Boone, that's the guy who gets credit for building the chapel. He's really an amazing figure, highly decorated veteran of World War I. Within two weeks, he received the Distinguished Service Cross, and then a week later, the Congressional Medal of Honor for amazing battlefield medical heroics, you know, administering to people on the battlefield with no protection. He was White House physician to Herbert Hoover. Captain Boone had a vision of the chapel being separated from the rest of the hospital complex and the chapel itself fitting into a special place on the hill. He'd taken over management of the place in 1943. And that's why the boundaries of the landmark designation get a little contentious, because DSHS wanted to preserve their options on part of the land near the chapel for a future parking lot. Now, parking lots are always villains in these things.
Yeah.
Bob Hubenthal, director of capital programs for DSHS, he says the landmark designation was not a pleasant experience.
The process itself was painful. The end results are something that that we can manage and we can live with.
You know, one thing it's worth pointing out, the 1944 chapel is in really good shape. This isn't some derelict old structure that nobody cares about and then some, you know, public agency wants to tear down or neglect until it collapses. In fact, Sarah Sneen, the landmarks coordinator for King County, that's the agency that oversees Shoreline's landmark program, she says DSHS should actually get some credit for taking care of the little chapel.
DSHS have been really good stewards. They've maintained the exterior and the interior quite well. And DNR owns the land, DSHS owns the building, so they work in tandem. For that site, and they've done a good job stewarding that building, and so it's really intact. We actually landmarked a number of the interior features as well because they were still there. And now the community uses the site a lot. They walk around, and they, you know, that's why they're so involved, because they do care about that site.
You know, and that community group and Janet Way would love to have some kind of memorandum of understanding with DSHS so the Shoreline community could offer programming inside the chapel. You know, it's still used once a week or so by the Furcrest chaplain, and there's precedent for this. Bob Hubenthal says that down at Western State Hospital, DSHS leases old officers' quarters to a nonprofit called Historic Fort Steilacoom, where they do programming and stuff. Still, Huventhal is concerned that the landmark designation for the chapel adds an additional layer of bureaucracy on what has been a simple, straightforward, and successful maintenance.
We would have to go through the whole Landmarks Commission review to make that kind of a visible change to the structure, because it is a listed historic structure. If it weren't, we would do what we believe is in our best interest to preserve the chapel and would take care of the roof.
Yeah, that would be, if they wanted to replace the roof, it'd be this big bureaucratic mm-hmm. thing in Bob's mind. But it may not be as onerous as he thinks. There's many, many landmarks in King County that go through that process all the time. Now, either way, the Shoreline Preservation folks, they seem to need a plan to connect with DSHS and formally discuss some kind of partnership. It's kind of an awkward phase right now because they're coming off this sort of contentious battle over the landmark designation. Now, in the meantime, Janet Way believes her group's role is to raise the profile of the chapel. And to that end, they have one more significant step that they want to take.
The plan is to go through the process for the National Register of Historic Places. That's the plan, because it needs more respect and status. And that would give it just additional, even though the landmark is fairly powerful, but you know, it just having that status as a National Register of Historic Places, you know, would be really a feather in the cap.
Yeah, and Janet told me yesterday that just recently DSHS and DNR cut down a bunch of trees near the chapel, which they had permission to do, but there's just this sort of, I don't know, it's not contentious exactly, but there's the, Fircrest is a DSHS facility. It's not officially, I mean, it's open to the public. You can go there and walk around, but it's not really a public park. There are still people attending this school for disabled people. Mm-hmm. It's just a tricky kind of a mushy gray area for what the public use of this facility really could be. And Bob Huventhal says, you know, they're willing to consider some kind of partnership with Janet's group, you know, and to sit down and talk about that once the pandemic's over. So
he seems to be saying, though, that the designation actually makes maintaining the channel more difficult.
You know, it does, but I don't think it's as onerous as DSHS believes. I mean, there's many, many publicly owned landmark buildings where it's just it's one more box to tick off to go through a process to replace a roof. You know, that building has the original, not the original roof, but a cedar shake style roof on it.
Right.
And if you can't get those out of Canada, it's easier to put on the composite tiles. But that would have to get permission because that changes the outward appearance of the building. So none of this stuff is black and white. It's all pretty gray. But the bigger issue is this cool chapel, which, again, I'd never heard of. And it's just right off the road. And it's a fabulous place to have programming of some kind.
Well, now that you've piqued our curiosity, but you say it's not exactly public. I mean, if you wanted to, are there weekly services offered there that you could attend?
No, there's nothing regularly scheduled there. There is a chaplain at Fircrest that offers stuff there, and they have done occasionally things in the past, but there's no regular public access to it. We couldn't even get inside of it. When I went and toured it with Janet earlier this year, we just walked around the outside of it and peered through the windows. And the interior is gorgeous. I've tweeted some pictures out from Twitter, and we'll have stuff at mynorthwest.com, but it's just
Jessica,
one of these beautiful buildings, the greatest, most beautiful building in Shoreline.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes you can get more support for these things if people like know what it is and can visit it and look at it and appreciate it.
Exactly, and it has an organ there and gorgeous, beautiful.
An organ too? A working organ?
Yes, a working organ. It's a great public asset.
All right. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
All of Felix's features are available anytime at MyNorthwest.com. It's called Factory Zero. It very nearly didn't exist, but today gets a visit from the president. Let's go live to Detroit and automotive reporter and broadcast legend, Jeff Gilbert at WWJ. What is the significance of Factory Zero, Jeff?
The significance of Factory Zero is it's GM's first plant dedicated to only making electric vehicles. So today was to be the grand opening anyway. Of course, the Biden administration is a big promoter of electric vehicles, so the president decided to come for the party.
Does this building already exist, or is it a reclaimed building? Does this represent bringing more manufacturing back to Detroit?
I don't know. Which question should I answer first?
The
building has been there for about 30 to 40 years. It was called the Detroit Hamtramck plant. It's made an abundance of vehicles, most recently big cars. And you may remember that name because in 2018, GM said, it's old. We don't need it anymore. We're going to close it. Well, after a lot of back and forth with the UAW, City of Detroit officials, they decided instead what they would do is gut it, spend $2 billion, and put in new equipment to make electric vehicles. So that's what they've been doing the last 2 years.
Well, that sounds like good news. So what kind of electric vehicles are they going to build there?
Well, they're not saying the whole lineup, but the first vehicle that's going to be made there is the Hummer. Now, this isn't the old Hummer that you remember from about a decade ago. This is a new one. It's electric. It's a GMC pickup called the Hummer, 1,000 horsepower, over $100,000, almost choked on that, and, you know, meant to be kind of a halo vehicle. The mass market vehicle they're going to make there in another year is an electric version of the Chevy Silverado pickup. They're going to show us what that looks like at the Consumer Electronics Show in January.
1,000 horsepower on the Hummer, huh? So what kind of... That's got to have a huge battery in it, doesn't it?
It does. It does. I mean, the battery is like 3,000 pounds. The vehicle, I had a chance to drive one. The vehicle really moves. Now, you know, the 1,000 horsepower is for bragging rights. You're never going to be able to use that on the road. But off-road, the vehicle, I mean, it's going to help you get over rocks, things of that nature. But the reality is this is a vehicle that shows the world that electric vehicles are not glorified golf carts. You can do a lot of cool things with them. So from the Hummer, that technology will get into vehicles that you and I will be able to buy every day, probably a few horsepower less than 1,000.
Jeff, you said the Silverado is going to be the next offering you're going to see early next year. I mean, what are we looking at the price tag at that? Because it seems to be right now one of the bigger issues for people jumping into this market, not only with the infrastructure backside, but is the price point. And I know it's getting better, but what's that Silverado are you guessing going to start at?
It'll probably be about a $5,000 price premium, I'm guessing, maybe a little bit more. And again, the question becomes, are there going to be government incentives? That wasn't in the infrastructure bill. It's in the very controversial bill that the president is pushing right now. And again, those EV incentives are controversial because, you know, right now as they stand, you get an extra bonus if the vehicle is union made, and that is something that is not liked by Tesla, EV startups, and the foreign manufacturers working in the U.S.
Okay, so these incentives take the form of a tax refund?
Well, it's still under development. For right now, they take the form of a tax refund, but GM doesn't have any because they cut out after you sell 200,000 vehicles, and GM has already sold a lot of EVs. So what's being debated in Congress would likely be in the form of a tax credit. But again, there's no assurance that the president's Build Back Better plan will pass, and no assurance that even if it fails, this will be brought up again. So it's still very much under debate.
On the high-end vehicles, how long would it take to recharge something like that, like the 1,000-horsepower Hummer?
It depends on what you have. You really do need a level 2 charger installed in your house. Charging with a wall socket is like trying to fill a glass of water with an eyedropper. You can do it, but it takes a long time. And there are fast chargers that can fill you to about 80% in a half an hour. So charging remains an issue. It's better than it used to be, but you know it's still not filling up with a tank of gas.
Now, Jeff, you're there in the heart of this discussion, and here's another controversial one for you. So here's a landmine. How much discussion is there ever when you guys talk about, you see how large that battery is in the Hummer, you know, the environmental concern of what it takes to mine the materials for that battery versus using an electric vehicle? How much of that discussion is there really going on? And I mean, is that a point that comes up?
Oh, yeah, it's a big point that comes up, and car companies are always trying to be greener than thou. So a lot of car companies are saying that we're looking for more environmentally friendly mining techniques. We're looking for batteries that use fewer of these rare earths, and we're looking for more and more ways to get these minerals from the U.S. as opposed to other countries. So it is a big issue, and it's an issue that is getting a little bit better, but you know, certainly it's out there, and there are new battery technologies that they are working on right now that perhaps in 4 or 5 years they won't need any of those metals. But yeah, you're right, it's a big issue.
And how many jobs in this newly reclaimed factory?
About 2,000. Many of them were people who had worked at that factory before, transferred to other GM plants and transferred back.
That sounds pretty good. So what is the status of Detroit these days? Are people excited about this? Is this part of the city's comeback?
It's certainly part of the city's comeback. I mean, obviously, at the ceremony, you'll see the mayor, the governor, all of those people there taking credit for this because it's a big civic event. The plant has always been in Detroit. I mean, it's been in Detroit for 40 years or so. So it's not like a new plant, but they do like the fact that it was saved. And as far as EVs goes, it's the same argument with politicians that you get in other areas. There are people who love them and people who are skeptical.
Jeff Gilbert, WWJ in Detroit. You can find his Car Chronicles podcast on the web. Jeff, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Congressional districts are being redrawn here in Washington State, as they are all over the country because of the 2020 census results. The State Redistricting Commission has finally agreed on a map that draws the districts. The problem is they missed their deadline. So what does that mean exactly? Let's go to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott to tell us why they had some trouble and what's next. Hannah.
Yes, good morning, Dave. So they had some trouble. They just couldn't come to agreement. It was a very cordial process. It's gone on for weeks, and they had engaged a bunch of people in the public, lots of public meetings, lots of meetings with businesses, trying to get to what they wanted to do. I know this has been going on for a couple of months, and I had talked to a couple of the commissioners going into the process, and really everybody was hoping to get to more competitive districts, some more purple districts.
Was there any particular district that gave them a problem?
Yakima was one. Yeah, the minority districts, large minority districts was something that was an issue. I think the Yakima area was going to be a largely Latino district, and there was some disagreement about that. So that's one of the reasons they didn't get.
Now, is that part of their part of their goal is to draw districts in a way that give more power to specific groups?
No, they're not. They're definitely not. They're supposed to make it more fair and make sure that it is representative of what you see in the census, right? So if there's a shift in population, you want to make sure that that representation is there. That is the overall goal. It's worded a very specific way, and I don't have it in front of me, but that's the general idea. This was bizarre, the way that this entire thing went down, because this is for... what they do, we have appointees, right? So there's four people on the commission. That's that you have two Democrats, you have two Republicans, and they have been doing this since 1990, as I think. So this will be the this was the fourth time that it had ever been done. They draw the maps for the next 10 years, and it was the first time ever that they didn't make it. They did not cross the finish line, and it here's a little bit of what went down. There was a final meeting on Monday night. It was covered on TVW, and it was 5 hours long. Now, this is supposed to be a public thing so that the public can be engaged. And what they were doing was coming in and out every half an hour, basically, checking in, because they'd go caucus together and they'd try to get to an agreement.
So they weren't discussing it in public then?
They were to some degree, but no, not everything. And so there's some concern and some question about that, about whether, you know, they failed in the requirement.
And why would they want to keep those discussions private? Is it because you're talking about specific ethnic groups?
No, that's one of the big questions, right? Yeah. So let me kind of draw the picture. So this is how it went down. There was a five-hour meeting. They would come in every half hour, check in and say, we're still in our talks. We'll be back. They also had not yet published the map, the final maps that they were discussing. And that is a requirement. So there was some question about what happened there. At the end, the final minutes of the video, this is what happened. You start hearing them talk about having internet issues.
Everyone's having connectivity issues.
Yeah, what's happening?
I'm having trouble too.
Yeah, I lost my internet at just, you know, the perfect time.
Okay, I just need a second. Can I get a second and a vote? Transmittal. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, terrific. Great job, everybody. Congratulations. I will now adjourn this meeting. Thank you.
So they patted each other. Everything's good. And the reporters who are covering this live are thinking, wait, did they just vote? Did they vote on the maps
that
we haven't seen yet? It was the transmittal letter, but that's what it sounded like. They did not. They did not. There was supposed to be a meeting, a press conference the following morning, which was yesterday at 10 a.m. And there was a lot of Twitter conversation going on amongst reporters saying, well, I guess we'll get our answers on exactly what happened at this press conference. And about 5 minutes before, no reason why, but they canceled the press conference. And then a couple of hours later, finally, they admit that they didn't make the deadline.
But they still have a map.
They did not have a map.
They
came out with it after the fact. So the map I sent you this morning, that came out yesterday, last evening.
It doesn't count because it was after the deadline?
That's correct. So there's no obligation.
Then who gets to decide the map then?
The state Supreme Court will now decide on how to draw the lines.
So they could completely redraw the lines if they wanted to?
They could if they wanted to. So what happened, though, is had the redistricting commission folks, they came to agreement on this final map, the one I sent you earlier today. They went ahead and sent that over to the state Supreme Court and said, because there's nothing saying that they can't. Normally, if it had been done at the regular process, they would have sent their finished map that was done on time to the legislature, and the legislature would have gone from there. Now it goes to the state Supreme Court, and they just said, please consider this. It had, you know, because they had a lot of public input in this. There's like 3,000, I think, different written comments, hundreds who came and spoke in the Zoom meetings that were going on for public comment and had their input on how these maps were going to be drawn. And the commissioners say they took all of that into account. So they were hoping that the court would at least consider what their final agreement came out like to draw their map. But there's no requirement for that, for the court to do so. And the court now has until April 30th to finish the work on the redistricting.
Okay, so which districts, I'm looking at the map now, which districts had the most changes?
And I'm not 100% sure on which ones. I think that we had, what they had to do was move 60,000 people from west, no, I'm sorry, from the east side of the state, basically, to the west. And I'm not 100% sure on exactly where this shift was. It looks, I know Mercer Island came up some, and I think that there was some talk of scooching some people around in the Snohomish County area, but I can't tell by looking at it. Can you tell by looking
at it? Well, looks at the it's too small in the Puget Sound area. The 9th district looks roughly the same. It looks like it still includes Mercer Island. It stops just below I-90, and it goes all the way down to what, Puyallup, I think.
I think so. Yes.
And then the and that's Adam Smith's district. The 8th district remains huge compared to when I ran there. There was I don't see how anybody can possibly. Can possibly cover that district. It goes from Pierce County through Chelan County and right up against Okanagan
County.
Yeah,
and there was a lot of discussion about that as well, yes.
So I guess the other big question is, does this put any incumbent's seat in particular danger, or change the will it change the party split in Washington State?
What the final map does is it represents, I think, a couple of more minority representation, I think. So a couple of large minority blocks that I think Yakima ended up going in, and I'm not sure what the second one was, where they are more weighted, I guess, is what they said in their press release. I know that we will get a chance to talk with these folks tomorrow because I said that they had canceled that press conference yesterday. And after they put this map out last night, they have scheduled a second press conference to go ahead and take some questions from the media, because there are so many questions about what they did, why they did it, what went wrong, because it's a very big deal for that this didn't get done in time on the deadline, especially after all of that input from the public and no requirement for the court to use that input.
Yeah. So in other words, this map that's being circulated now could be completely changed by the Supreme Court.
Could be ditched.
And they can use any basis they want, huh?
They can. Yeah, they can do what they want. They're the commissioners. And then they have to, you know, it has to still go to the legislature, though.
Ah, okay.
But this is going to be what you use, right? So the first time that these maps and boundaries are going to be used, midterms 2022. So that's our next November election.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now, sponsored by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. Among the 33,000 runners in the New York City Marathon earlier this month were two friends with an uncommon bond. CBS's Naomi Ruckham has the story.
It takes some grit to train on the streets of New York City.
Car, car, car.
But for Sarah Kate Gillingham and Dave Kane, this is a celebration of life.
It's really nice to be able to like sit here and smile and laugh about it, but it was a very dark time.
That dark time dates back more than 4 years ago, when Kane was fighting for his life.
The diagnosis was pretty grim.
Doctors found cancer in the bile ducts of his liver. He needed a transplant. And when word spread on Facebook, his friend Gillingham stepped up.
I don't know, it just felt a calling. I felt like I am in a really good position to do this.
After a final hug, doctors removed 60% of Gillingham's liver and transplanted it to Kane. 2 weeks later, they were smiling, and 2 years later, marking their surgical anniversary.
Sarah Kate saved my life. That's what's so great about this opportunity to run and to publicize, you know, the incredible, you know, bravery and generosity and love of Sarah Kate and the opportunity to be a donor.
Their race will raise money for the American Liver Foundation, and they hope it will raise awareness about organ donation.
If there's one thing you would want the public to know about being a living donor? What is it?
I guess it's that it's totally possible to make a bigger impact on the world than you think is possible by doing this. Digging deep in yourself to give something that is very scary.
Gillingham now coaches other donors through the experience and says in saving Kane's life, she added meaning to her own. Naomi Ruckham, CBS News, New York.
And now from the G and Ursula Show, it starts at 9. G. Scott joins us. You know, G, they say that America has been slow to make social progress, but let it be known that we are the country that finally liberated Britney Spears. Here she is.
It's a really long time to be in a situation you don't want to be in. So I'm just grateful, honestly, for each day and being able to have the keys to my car and being able to be independent and feel like a woman.
She has the keys to her car. She can even control her own money now.
Owning an ATM card, seeing cash for the first time, being able to buy candles. It's the little things for us women, but it makes a huge difference. And I'm grateful for that. You know, it's nice. It's really nice.
She can buy candles. So the world is finally changing, G.
Yeah. Well, the world, especially here in the United States, we are the reasons why she needed it in the first place. Let's go back to the tabloids. Let's go back to the pressure, the paparazzis, and everything that she had gone through. 2007 is when her marriage ended with Kevin Federline during that time. And then when that ended, it seemed like that there was a real spiral. So, yeah, sure. You know what? We could sit here and talk about, we can vilify her parents, right? We can say, oh, my goodness, how dare you? No doubt about it. They own some of this, right? But at the same time, if it, in my opinion, if not for that, I don't even think Britney Spears would be alive still. I think that's where it was heading. You go back to those times and remember how she was all the explosive public appearances that she was making. It was just out of control. And then here she is today. So yes, the parents, yes, they need to take some responsibility, but so do we.
Well, apparently her parents did some things that she says they need to be in jail for. I mean, even in her court appearance, she talked about how she can't even have children because they won't allow her to take out her IUD. So we're talking about some pretty serious body autonomy issues. You know, if I may say, she was sort of indentured to them to perform and make money and couldn't get her hands on any of that. So good for her. I think we all looked at this and went, come on, it can't be that bad. I mean, really? Like Britney Spears? But everything that's coming out now, she was in a bad situation, and I'm happy for her that she's finally revealing her truth.
Three sides to every story. Britney's side, the parents' side, and the truth.
Yeah, she needed help for sure.
Let me just say again, I am not absolving the parents away from their responsibility and the negativity and the harm that they caused. That's not where I'm going with this. For sure, no doubt. But I also want to say that we, the people as well, we people that consume the news before social media, before, remember, like, that was kind of like the sweet spot, right? Like, mom and daddy and them didn't really have Facebook yet. It was MySpace during those times. I'm just talking about when all of this started with her, you know, and it took away
the
cards.
And we all thought it was a good idea, the conservatorship, because she was exhibiting bizarre behavior. But here's the thing, and I think this is what you're getting at, G. We all treated her mental crisis as a sideshow.
Yes, we
did. Instead of as opening our hearts and going, oh, she's in crisis. Because nobody talks about what it looks like to be in crisis.
Come on.
Nobody talks about that you can be depressed and function in your job and smile and be the peppy person. And you can be in a mental crisis and it's not fun to watch. That it's something you need to reach out to that person and help.
The hashtag Free Britney, right? Like a lot of it was great because I do think that the hashtag Free Britney, and we all know the movement that social media can make, the power that it has. I do believe that that is the reason. And well, she says it. That is the reason why she's free. But I just want to be most of these youngsters that was hashtag Free Britney, they had no idea what was going on back then.
They didn't know our Britney. They didn't know our Britney G.
No, not at all.
And can we talk about Adele now? Because that's also in the news.
Oh. Oh, wow.
Now, I watched the show. I was very impressed. It was beautifully done. But then I find out, because I'll admit, I'm out of my depth on both Britney and Adele, okay? But I've been told that most of the coverage this week was not about her her relaunch of her career here.
It was her physical appearance.
It was her weight, yeah.
Yeah. You know, James this morning, and I know James is listening because he just doesn't leave unless he's listening. he said that to me this morning, right? And it kind of like, I was like, okay, yeah, I'm ready to talk a deal with Colleen and Dave, no problem. And when he told me that, I haven't been talking about her physical appearance. I've been talking about her amazing voice. I've been talking about the interview. I've been talking about the setting of the concert. I've been talking about everything Adele. I just love her energy, who she is, even when she's not singing, when she's talking. Like, when she talks, she's so real, right?
She's a boss,
but,
yeah.
But then when James said that to me, I caught myself. And I don't know this, and I hate to admit something, guys, but I have to admit this. Do I like Adele more now because her physical appearance is better? I think subconsciously, I do. If I'm being really honest, because in the very beginning of Adele, I wasn't really rocking with Adele like that. But all of a sudden,
you're paying more attention to her.
Yeah, and like,
well,
I feel
terrible. Maybe you're just at a point in your life where her music now resonates with you, right? Give yourself some break. I appreciate the honesty, but, you know, give yourself some compassion that maybe you've just matured and now you can enjoy Adele.
I didn't even know what she looked like before. I grew up when you didn't know what singers looked like. You just heard their voices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad her life is together, her voice is good, and that you think her physique is more suited to her music. Gee.
Yeah, I feel guilty though, right? Like when right
Colleen
when James
just
said,
said you don't have to feel guilty. So stop.
No. You know what? Thanks, Colleen. I appreciate it. No, I always liked Adele for her voice and who she was.
There
it was
you
never
are.
About any physical appearance.
There we go.
And we couldn't even get to T Swift. She's owning everybody in the industry, but yeah, good for them.
We can talk T Swift tomorrow.
All right.
Do you even know who T Swift is, bro?
He's a linebacker for the Green Bay Packers.
She probably could be. She can do anything.
Hey, T Swift does sound like a linebacker, don't it?
Gee, you're an Ursula. 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio.
See you guys.
You can't mention Seattle without invoking the name of a Native American chief. And Heather Bosch is going to tell us how to find out more about the city's namesake and his people. She reports on Cairo Radio's Charity of the Month.
In a West Seattle building constructed in traditional style.
A lot of people don't realize that, you know, there was wool here. It would have been, mountain sheep.
Jolene Haas points out items on display at the Duwamish Longhouse and Cultural Center.
Well, yeah, this is just to indicate different styles of the use of cedar.
Those would be tools?
Yeah, some of these were found using, the rocks and stuff as hammers, pestles for food.
There aren't only artifacts, but descriptions and drawings to show how the Duwamish people would use them.
Instead of just coming to a museum and seeing like a broken piece of, you know, whatever, and you can't imagine how they used it, what we wanted to do is really bring it all to life.
Because, she says, the Duwamish aren't just part of the area's past, but very much part of its present.
We are part of the large urban Indian community that is centralized here in the Puget Sound in King County, and actually a lot of surrounding counties around Seattle, too.
And the tribe has a special influence on the state's largest city.
We're really unique in that this city is the only city named after a tribal chief, and it just so happens to be Chief Seattle, who is Duwamish and Suquamish.
The Longhouse and Cultural Center in West Seattle serves as a headquarters and gathering place for tribal members, and Haas says, also importantly, a place where others can learn about the tribe.
So yeah, we have art markets, we have public events, and we have school tours in here.
Though the history of the U.S. and its native people is a long and often difficult one, Haas says, by getting the community involved, the center focuses on what we have in common.
Because there's just so much to share. There's so much to learn. As human beings, we just have so much to be, you know, grateful for the connection that we have and we should have with one another.
Cairo's Heather Bosch. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.